Support for the World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs. To learn about developments currently shaping markets, industries, and the global economy, subscribe to the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes and Stitcher.
Iran in black and white and color, today on The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Photographer Randy Goodman first visited Iran in the 1980s. She went back last year, and now she's combining pictures from both trips.
So these little giggling girls in black and white, representing the early 80s, surrounded by this collage of women in everyday life, all produced in color, just gives you a sense of some of the changes. And the changes are about the struggle between tradition and modernity.
Plus, a killer whale named Granny.
Oh, I was so excited to see her. She is amazing, affectionately known as Granny because she is the oldest known wild killer whale. Scientists estimate that she could be as much as 105.
Those stories ahead on The World. We have two stories from East Africa to start the show today, and both have to do with how gender and sexual orientation are viewed in that region. In a few minutes, we'll hear about discrimination against LGBT people in Uganda. First, we turn to northern Tanzania and a tradition there that allows women to marry each other. Except this isn't same-sex marriage the way we understand it here in the U.S., Abigail Howarth has a piece about this in Marie Claire magazine. It's titled, Why Straight Women Are Marrying Each Other.
Well, it's a very, very interesting tradition that's kind of being revived. It's been around for a long time. Nobody actually knows when it began, but the original purpose of it was because women can't inherit property in Tanzania. In this particular tribal group, they have no chance of inheriting property. So they developed a system that if a husband died, to enable the widow to keep her property, she could marry another woman, a younger woman. And if the widow didn't have any sons, then this younger wife would then take a boyfriend, have some children, and give her heirs. And then the property could stay in the family.
And the tradition is called, is it Nyumba Ntobu? Am I saying that right?
Yes, Nyumba Ntobu, yes, yes. House of Women, yes.
So the local tradition translates to House of Women. Does it actually translate to marriage? Is House of Women the same as marriage? Do we call it marriage because we understand it that way?
Well, certainly in their culture, it has the legitimacy of marriage. So their domestic domain is sacred. If a woman is married to another woman, then they have all the same rights as any other married couple. So certainly.
And in the context of the global movement that we've seen for same-sex marriage, what struck you as different about these marriages as you were reporting on them?
I think it's very interesting that, you know, these alternative family arrangements have been around for a long time, and we're just really getting wise to them because of the interest in same-sex marriage. I mean, the women don't have sex in these marriages, and homosexuality is taboo. It's forbidden for men. And a lot of people told me they didn't even realize that homosexuality existed for women. So in that sense, their culture is sort of quite behind the times.
So it underscores in a way that marriage is an economic arrangement.
Yes, in a lot of these cases, there is an economic reason originally. But I think what's interesting in this case is that younger women are embracing the tradition as a way of empowering themselves, that they're realizing that there is an alternative, that they can actually have more control over their own lives because their culture is polygamous, it's very patriarchal. There's a very high rate of domestic violence. There is more awareness now that they shouldn't be subjected to that. And although it may be in an ideal world, this isn't their ideal arrangement to marry another woman, but it's certainly a sort of an answer. It's a resourceful way for them to take control over their own lives by marrying a woman, having more equality in the relationship, and yes, being able to hold on to their property and expand their economic prospects as well, because the women I met were very much working together to build up their own livelihoods and their own families and have children, which is a source of wealth to them.
Tell us about a particular couple, just so we can have a better picture of it.
There was one young woman who was 18 when she got married to an older woman, and she told me that she had resisted her father's attempts to marry her off before then. So she put it off, and then finally she decided that the best thing for her would be to marry a woman, and then she could choose her own lover and then be in a relationship where she had some economic security and not be subjected to any violence, which she had witnessed growing up in her own family and with her own father. And she was absolutely determined that that wasn't going to happen to her. And she had a boyfriend in this new relationship who she'd already had two children, and she'd been married for 3 years when I met her. And this boyfriend, she said, well, you know, I sort of have control over the relationship. I can dictate when I see him. If he doesn't treat me well, I can just say goodbye to him and find another boyfriend. And, you know, this is great sort of liberation for them. So it's really interesting the way that they're sort of adapting the tradition to meet their particular needs at this moment in time.
And given that it's a traditional practice, but it's undergoing a kind of revival and women are actively choosing it in situations where maybe before they wouldn't have.
Yes.
Is there unease about that? I mean, usually when there's this kind of change, there's somebody who's getting a little nervous.
Yes. Well, a lot of the young men I spoke to were very anti the tradition for quite obvious reasons. You know, I mean, it's quite threatening to them that the women that they would be able to marry are suddenly saying, well, sorry, no, I'm not going to enter into this relationship where I'm, you know, going to be subjugated. Some other men were more open to it because they would think, well, this is actually quite, you know, it's quite good for us. They can have relationships with women in these marriages and then not have very much responsibility because the children who are born, the men don't actually have any responsibility for. So it's really up to them if they want to be involved in their lives, or the women as well, you know, they can decide that. But yes, a lot of the young men were anti it, and they were saying that these, you know, there's a risk of HIV and don't sleep with these women, and they were trying to sort of put each other off. And so, yes, I think they did find it quite confronting. But on the other hand, you know, I think it possibly also makes them look at the behaviour that the male behaviour that's typical in that culture that has prompted a lot of the young women to feel like that. So some men were quite sympathetic as well.
Abigail Howarth is Senior International Editor for Marie Claire magazine. Abigail, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Tanzania is among several African nations where homosexuality is illegal and where being identified as gay can result in a long prison sentence. That's the case in Uganda, too. But that didn't stop LGBT Ugandans from holding Pride Week celebrations last week. That is, until police raided one of the events, arresting at least 20 people. Other Pride celebrations in Uganda were canceled after that. Human rights lawyer Nicholas Opiyo has been working with Pride organizers and community members since the raid. How are people doing?
People are very tense in Uganda. People fear that there will be a rise of a new anti-gay sentiment in this country. And so many people are living in fear. The community right now is in panic and are just watching very keenly to see how things unfold in the next coming days.
I was surprised to hear that there even was a Pride celebration in Uganda, given the hostility towards LGBT people there. What kind of celebration was it?
Pride events in Uganda are not the same as Pride events in most of the West. They are private events held in secluded places away from public view. For the past 5 years, that is what has been Pride events. In cases where they are held in a nightclub, for example, the nightclub is closed off to the public and is only exclusively made available to the LGBT communities and their allies.
And are they secret?
They are in many ways only invite events. If you're not invited, you may not have access to it.
But for safety.
It's for safety. But the state is made aware. The state knows the program. There's an advance notification to authorities about events. And normally, the authorities allow the event to go on without interruption.
So why do you think that the event on Thursday was raided?
I think the events on Thursday was raided because of a homophobic police officer who was acting on his own initiative, just broke into the club and did what he did. I think he realized much later that what he had done was unwise, was uncalled for. But as soon as he acted, the people in the state, the Minister for Ethics and Integrity, then swung in and took over the event and made it now a political and public issue.
In what sense? A political and public issue as an event that shouldn't have happened, or in a protective way?
No, in a very negative way. The government minister for information addressed the press, saying that there is no space for gay people in this country. In fact, the minister threatened in my presence that he would mobilize a mob to come and beat up people if they showed up for the Pride event. So he just became so homophobic and took out a public attack on the gay community.
What recourse do you have? What battle can you fight over this?
We have had a series of meetings and engaged development partners. We have spoken to the American Embassy in Kampala, and they have been extremely helpful. We have spoken to the British High Commission here to make sure that they make the case to government that they should be accommodative to the LGBTI community. We are also reflecting on a possibility of seeking legal redress, even though we have no hope in the legal system. But more importantly, let the world know what is happening in Uganda, and perhaps that can bring some pressure on them and make them relent and give us space to celebrate our identity.
This was clearly a terrible event that unleashed a torrent of further hostility. But what are the challenges you're living with every day in Uganda?
The lived experiences of gay people in this country is horrific. They express themselves in unreported, unseen experiences, from family members who reject people's identity, to the community that rejects people's identity, to the grocery store next door that, even though they sell you grocery, do so while insulting and saying, you know, homophobic things to you. Or really the challenges of accessing government services, like going to a school. You have to hide your identity to be able to get a job. You have to hide your identity to be able to access schooling in this country. As soon as your identity is known, you're expelled from school. If you're lucky to escape alive, many people are beaten by a mob in schools. So the daily lived experience of the LGBTI community is a silent, homophobic attack from community members, from family members, and a denial of access to public services.
Why is the situation in Uganda so bad, and why is it so hard to move forward on rights for LGBT people there?
Because religious groups have a firm grip on the state. And the U.S. Embassy here in Uganda and the U.S. leadership have been extremely helpful in supporting the local gay community here. To find space for expression, to find space for support. They've been extremely supportive. But on the other hand, you have private American Pentecostal groups that have vast influence in this country, that have the podium on which they preach every single day and every Sunday to impart an anti-gay agenda. So in so many ways, you have both good and bad of America playing out here.
Nicholas Opio is a human rights lawyer in Uganda. Thank you, Nicholas.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
We have just enough time now for a quick note from the Olympics in Rio. It's about what surely is already one of the iconic moments of the 2016 Games. It happened on Monday, right after the women's rugby sevens final. Our colleagues at the BBC caught up with the two women involved.
I'm Isadora Cerullo, known as Izzy, and I play for the Brazilian women's sevens rugby team.
Hi, I'm Marjorie. I'm the competition services manager for one of the stadia that's been used for the Olympic Games here in Rio.
And it's great to have you along, not least because you've been in all the news sites around the world. Because what happened the other day?
I officially proposed to Izzy.
On the rugby pitch?
On the rugby pitch.
Spoiler alert, I said yes.
Oh, thank goodness.
Congratulations, round of applause. Had you planned this long on the pitch, or was it a spontaneous thing?
Not to this extension. I mean, I wanted to do something special. I wanted to do something during the Olympic Games. But when I walked on the pitch and I saw all those cameras, I was like, oh my God. I really do hope she says yes, otherwise I'm going to be famous for a while.
So the proposal was at this tournament. Will the wedding be at another one?
So the running joke, Marjorie knows someone who organizes the Amsterdam Sevens rugby tournament, so the running joke was if we'll have the wedding there.
Brazilian rugby player Isadora Cerullo and Olympic event manager Marjorie Enya now engaged and speaking there to our BBC colleagues in Rio de Janeiro. You're listening to The World. Here's a tricky question for you. What do humans, short-finned pilot whales, and orcas have in common? They're the only three mammals known to experience menopause. Even chimpanzees, our closest primate cousins, are able to reproduce throughout their natural life. So why don't we have that same ability? It's a bit of an evolutionary mystery. But researchers are hoping that orcas, aka killer whales, could help us figure it out. My BBC colleague, Victoria Gill, made a documentary exploring what orcas can teach us about our own life cycle. So why is the menopause considered so hard to explain in evolution?
Well, it's a bit of a conundrum when you sort of think about it in terms of the kind of Darwinian doctrine that a lot of people might be familiar with, the idea of natural selection. So that's that anything that decreases your chances of your genes being passed to the next generation, that would be sort of phased out by this process of natural selection. So why would any animal evolve to stop reproduction, to stop passing on their genes so early in life? And it's a conundrum. It's also extremely rare. It's something only seen in three mammals: ourselves, killer whales, and this lesser-known family of whales, the short-finned pilot whales. And these killer whales have been documented for so long, these killer whales off the North Pacific coast, that they provide the perfect wild ecosystem to start looking at this big evolutionary question.
So tell us about the orcas.
Well, they're amazing. It was a real pleasure to go out there with the Centre for Whale Research, and the British researchers from the Universities of Exeter and York were there working with them, working with the people who've lived alongside and studied these whales for so long. It's a population known as a clan of 83 animals, and they're called the Southern Residents because they come into the Harrow Strait, these sort of inshore waters between Canada and Washington State every single summer, and they only eat salmon, and that's why they come there, because they're hunting the salmon. And they're beautiful, graceful, huge animals that the intelligence really radiates off them. And one really interesting thing about them is how social they are, how family bonded they are. And it's these social bonds and these interactions that have really shown just how much of an important role these post-reproductive females, these post-menopausal females, are playing in the family group.
What are they actually doing that's so remarkable?
Well, some of the things that the researchers have already published findings on, they've looked at 40 years of data that have been gathered by documenting and cataloguing these whales. And what they found is that these great older matriarchs, often post-reproductive females who've been post-reproductive for many years, they lead the group. And even more strangely, they're not just in the lead showing their families and their pods where to find the salmon, it would seem, but they do that more when there's less salmon around. So during a bad year, the salmon sort of fluctuates, there's good years and bad years. And during a bad year when the salmon is really low, that's when they really see these great matriarchs taking the lead. What they infer from that is that there's this accumulated wisdom, this kind of ecological wisdom about where to find fish when there's a bit of a drought. So they're playing an incredibly important role in feeding their families and keeping their families alive.
And in that sense, you can presumably make an evolutionary argument for menopause.
Well, yeah, that's quite right, because that's the other way in which we can ensure that we pass on our genes to the next generation, by looking after our family's family, our children's children. It's something that has been seen in hunter-gatherer populations in humans as well. There's some really interesting literature that's come out of a researcher at the University of Utah called Kristen Hawkes, who studied the Hadza people of northern Tanzania, and she's seen these industrious grandmothers in this Hadza population of people working to look after the youngsters, look after their daughters' children. And they call this the grandmother effect, where basically the grandmothers are having a real impact on, a measurable impact on the survival of their children. And it's being seen here in the orcas too. In fact, the researchers actually measured that when these older matriarchs die, there's an eightfold increase in the chance of her sons dying, her adult sons dying in the year following her death. So the impact is particularly on these sons, on these adult male orcas, but it's having a measurable impact on the survival probability of her family. So by assuming this incredibly important role, by assuming this leadership role, she's really having an impact on the future generations of her own pod.
You spent time following one particularly famous orca, Granny.
Yeah.
Please tell us about her.
Oh, I was so excited to see her. She is amazing. She's called J2. That's her formal name, because all of the three pods in the clan are called J, K, and L pod. They belong to it. The whole clan comes together in this place, but. Granny is the leader of J-Pod. She's called J2, but affectionately known as Granny because she is the oldest known wild killer whale. Scientists estimate that she could be as much as 105. They estimated her age when they first started studying these orcas in the 1970s, from the age of her offspring. And when they started studying her, she'd already stopped having her own baby. She'd already stopped having her own calves. But since then, she's been in the lead of this pod throughout the entire study. And even more strangely, there's actually an adult male from another pod who has latched on to Granny. This is a male orca from L pod who lost his own mother but managed to survive that, then apparently moved to K pod and tagged along with two other older females. They both died, and now he's been hanging out with Granny for several years. And the researchers say they will see them swimming side by side, very close to each other. And even that some of these older matriarchs will be sharing food with these adult males. So perhaps Granny is sharing food with her adopted son or her toy boy.
So what is the big takeaway here in terms of how we understand menopause and perhaps menopause in our own human society?
Well, I think the takeaway message from some of the work that the researchers have already published is that the role of females post-reproductively does not stop. It doesn't fade away. If anything, it becomes more important, that this wisdom and this knowledge that can only be garnered over time becomes extremely valuable post-reproductively.
My BBC colleague, Victoria Gill, thanks for telling us about all of this.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Before we head to the break, here's a preview of a story we'll have on the show tomorrow. A young man living in Miami's Little Haiti neighborhood didn't dare to dream of going to college, but now he's about to become a freshman in Wisconsin.
Have you ever seen snow before?
No.
You're gonna see some.
Yeah, I heard about it.
You need to get a big jacket.
Yeah, I know.
His soccer coach pushed him and many others all the way through high school, urging his players to consider the possibility. And this is what the players would tell him.
Well, now, you know, coach, I cannot leave because if I leave and I'm the only one here with my mom and then she has nobody else, I say, I understand that. But I say, well, if you want to help your mom that don't have anything right now, she's struggling. The best thing that you can do, move away.
And get a degree. How that soccer coach managed to get 14 of his players off to college this year. That's tomorrow on the show. And you're listening to The World. I'm Jeb Sharp. Russian athletes competing in Rio are taking a lot of flack for their country's doping scandal. Some say that's not entirely fair.
The individual athletes are essentially pawns of that whole situation, and state-sponsored doping, let's remember, the thing that's really wrong with it is that it's a human rights violation.
That's ahead on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. American swimmer Lily King has gotten a lot of attention at the Rio Olympics this week, and not just for winning a gold medal in the 100-meter breaststroke. King also called the silver medalist in that event, Russia's Yulia Efimova, a drug cheat, because of Efimova's two recent suspensions for doping violations. Today, a new twist in this saga. Efimova qualified for the 200-meter breaststroke final, while King failed to make the cut. Sally Jenkins is a sports columnist for The Washington Post. She's bothered by how this feud between King and Efimova is playing out in Rio.
I think it's the excessiveness, you know, splashing water in her face, turning backs on her, refusing to shake her hand after the competition. You know, it's very understandable that people are uneasy about the Russian presence in these Olympics because the IOC truly did bungle, you know, the entire deal. But the individual athletes are essentially pawns of that whole situation, and state-sponsored doping, let's remember the thing that's really wrong with it is that it's a human rights violation. A lot of these athletes were pressured by their government and their federation into using certain substances. And I just think that the subtleties of the situation really got lost in the narrative of Lily King beats, you know, wins the Cold War and beats an evil Russian, you know, cheater.
Tell us more about Yulia Efimova, because there are several things in your piece that I had no knowledge of.
I can't claim to be the world's expert on her either, but I do know that she was born in Grozny. She was
in Chechnya.
In Chechnya. Her family had to leave there in the midst of the first Chechenian war, and she wound up at in her late teens. She swam for one of the large Russian swimming clubs through most of her childhood and adolescence. And as in her late teens, when she was about 18 or 19, her federation sent her to Los Angeles to train under a renowned coach named Dave Salo, because there was some fear that I think that she was weary of swimming and was going to quit swimming. And so she ended up in L.A.
with an American coach.
With an American coach, a very prominent American coach. And so I got in touch with him, and he basically said, you know, she's not the monster that she's being branded as. And so really the column that I wrote was based very much on, you know, his human knowledge of her. I just wanted to put a human face on her because she really had become almost a cartoon character.
And what are the actual doping allegations against her?
There were two instances, and they're not allegations. They were actually, she's admitted to them, so they're concrete. She used what they call a supplement. If you go into any GNC store, you'll see these big barrels of protein supplements.
Sure.
Almost virtually all athletes use them, but you have to be very careful and check the contents. And she bought something in a GNC store back in 2013. It had a hormone in it called DHEA. It was listed on the contents of the barrel, but her version is that her English was so poor that she couldn't read it or didn't read it. And the World Anti-Doping Agency actually agreed with her, and they knocked her ban down from usually it's a mandatory 2 years, and instead they knocked it down to 16 months. She served it out, just like a lot of American athletes have who've gotten doping bans, and came back to compete. And then in January, the World Anti-Doping Agency decided to ban a substance called meldonium, which has been in very common use throughout Eastern Europe. It's a heart medication. WADA decided after many years of this sort of being a common practice to put it on the banned list in January. That substance stays in the body for several months. So they ended up having to do a U-turn because they realized that over 200 athletes were still testing positive for it after the ban went into effect in January. So it's entirely possible she did test positive for it, but there is a lot of question as to whether she was behaving perfectly legally, stopped taking meldonium, and yet still tested positive for it because it was still in her system like so many other athletes had experienced. So certainly, you know, you'd like to think she was doing nothing but drinking Evian, but that's not how world-class athletes train these days, including Americans.
You know, the Olympics always has this, right? The geopolitics always, you know, loom over the rest of it, but you would just say this goes too far.
Well, I think usually it's very satisfying, but there was something that made at least me personally a little uneasy about it. I thought it crossed the line. The splashing of water in her face, the refusal to acknowledge her, there was an element of shunning and shaming that felt a little cruel.
Do you have any thoughts about why that would erupt at this Olympics?
Well, I think there's a lot of frustration among the athletes towards the International Olympic Committee, which has been very feckless. They have to do some very hard thinking about, you know, what is truly performance enhancing and what should be permissible because it simply helps athletes recover. And I just think that there could be some smarter thinking on all of this rather than this black and white, cheater clean, purity versus evil.
Absolutely. Sally, what else strikes you in Rio?
You know, it's funny that everybody talks about clean athletes when the swimming pools are so dirty here. That's an irony. I don't know if you've seen, but the pools are turning green.
That's a sweet, I don't know if it's a sweet irony.
It could be a smelly irony. I don't know.
Sally Jenkins is a sport columnist for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Brazil got its first gold medal of the Rio Olympics this week, thanks to women's judo and 24-year-old Rafaela Silva. It was a huge deal in Rio, especially because Silva is from the City of God, one of the city's toughest favelas. It was the subject of a 2002 movie of the same name, and since it's been synonymous with violence and street crime. The World's Will Carlos went to the City of God to meet with some young filmmakers there who are trying to dispel that cliched vision of their home.
Vamos fazer uma longa viagem a uma cidade chamada de Deus.
That's Brazilian rapper MV Bill from his 2013 track Traficando Informação, or Trafficking Information. Let's make a long journey, he says, to a city called God. A lot of journalists from around the world have made journeys into the Cidade de Deus, or City of God, in the last few days. Ever since local hero Rafaela Silva won Brazil's first gold medal at the Rio Games. It's a wonderful story. A tough, strong Afro-Brazilian woman from a tough, strong neighborhood becomes a world champion. Despite years of online racial attacks, Silva rises to the top of the judo world. Brazil applauds her achievements, and she inspires the kids of her community. I meet with Bruno Rafael and Sergio Leal, two more homegrown talents from this poor neighborhood. They've been working on a documentary of their community.
Nós estamos tentando revelar uma cidade de Deus.
That's Leal, who goes by the name DJTR. He says, we're trying to show a city of God that for 50 years has been striving to escape the crime pages and enter the culture pages, the sports pages, the social pages of the newspapers. Heroic achievements like that of their friend, Rafaela Silva, work wonders to help rid the community of the stigma of the violent movie that was named after it. But Silva is just one of many future champions TR and Rafael have met while making their own movie. One of the first names Rafael mentions is City of God native MV Bill.
Da minha sobrinha sou eu, MV Bill. Encontrei minha salvação na cultura hip hop. Tem outros que entraram pra vida do crime querendo ganhar hip hop.
MV Bill raps, I found my salvation in the culture of hip hop. Others went into crime, hoping they could beat EBOP, that's Rio's elite police squad. If you're brave, he continues, come here and see society giving back to the CDD, Cidade de Deus. Rafael explains the message rappers like MV Bill are sending.
Então assim, na política a gente vê muitas coisas erradas.
In politics, he says, we see many things that are wrong, and we feel prisoners of that. So this frees us. Through music, art, dance, through all the elements of hip-hop, we're freeing what is imprisoned inside us. And it's not just rappers, says TR. The community is also home to painters, photographers, and visual artists of all kind, who they'll feature in their film. Silva, the gold medal winner, is in the documentary too, but there are other sports heroes, like Thiago Marreta Santos, a mixed martial arts fighter who's risen to the top of Brazil's ultimate fighting scene. And TR says he wants to stress something.
É óbvio que Rafaela, que Marreta são referências, sim.
Look, he says, it's obvious that Rafaela and Marreta are icons, but we're not sitting here waiting for them to win medals or trophies for them to become our icons. The fact that they've used sports to better themselves, to find a new way of life, already reflects well for every one of us here, especially the children. TR and Rafael's documentary, 50 Years in the Cidade de Deus, also features everyday people. Their goal is to show that there are lots of inspiring people in this embattled community. And this isn't just some romantic fantasy. It's a survival tactic, TR says. Just last month, a day of violence in CDD left a 34-year-old woman dead from a bullet to the face. That same day, another resident was shot and injured, and a local police station was attacked by drug dealers.
Menos uma estatística do crime, na estatística da...
Just one less statistic, one less obituary in the newspapers is already a huge victory for the people here, TR says. These local icons are already champions, whether they're on TV or not. We, here, in the community, know who they are. For the World, Will Carlos, City of God, Rio de Janeiro.
It sounds like something out of an old James Bond film, a secret nuclear-powered military base built deep into the ice of Greenland at the height of the Cold War, ready to launch an attack against the Soviet Union just over the North Pole. Turns out it actually was a real plan, and it was worked on for almost a decade in the 1960s at a frigid place called Camp Century. But the idea never panned out, and the base was abandoned. Left behind, though, were tons of waste expected to be buried forever in the ice. Well, forever isn't what it used to be, thanks to global warming, and a new study has found that the ice covering Camp Century is likely to begin melting within just a few decades, and that would expose the waste to the environment. William Colgan of York University in Toronto is the lead author of the study.
What they were doing in Greenland is pretty unusual and far-fetched. They were trying to explore the feasibility of deploying ballistic missiles on rail cars just beneath the surface of the Greenland ice sheet. It was a very ambitious project that they called Project Iceworm. And Camp Century was, I guess, a testing ground. Camp Century was active between 1959 and 1967. And over that time, a fair amount of waste was generated. I guess, first off, there's the large amount of infrastructure or physical waste. Then there was a large amount of biological waste, or a fancy way of saying sewage. Then we speculate there's probably a fair amount of chemical waste, in particular PCBs, and they're pretty toxic and long-lived. And then to top it off, there was even just a touch of low-level radioactive waste.
And to the extent that they had one, what was their plan for the waste?
The waste plan was that it would be entombed for eternity, under perpetually accumulating snowfall.
And of course, we're seeing the opposite with climate change. Greenland has started to melt quickly. What are you seeing in terms of ice melt?
Well, we haven't seen any net melt at Camp Century yet, but the business as usual climate scenarios that we explored suggested that by roughly 75 years from now, Camp Century will begin to experience more melt than snowfall, and eventually the camp will be exposed at the ice sheet surface, like peeling back the layers on an onion.
And if we do get to that point when the waste is actually entering the local ecosystem, what is the logical outcome?
Well, of course, it would be very nice. This is yet another reason it would be nice to get off the business as usual emissions scenario and avert the level of warming that would cause this base to be remobilized. In the event that we cannot get off business as usual scenario, then I guess we will have to start to look at remediation options for this site and the other sister ice sheet bases that the U.S. Army engineers built towards the end of this century. But perhaps the big takeaway from our study is that how this legacy will be dealt with is uncertain, because we have Denmark and the U.S. both agreed to establish the base there. Which of those parties might be responsible for remediation activities is not clear. And in addition, Greenland is now a new self-governing nation that wasn't a party to the original treaty. So the political liability associated with Camp Century and its sister bases is far from clear.
It's so interesting, and interesting to think of other situations like that that may crop up in a similar way around the globe.
Yeah, we believe that climate change might present a new pathway to political tension associated with these sorts of multinational and multigenerational waste issues. I mean, the ice sheet and Camp Century are a very special case, but there's a broad analogy with sea level rise and low elevation waste sites around the world and how to deal with those in the coming century.
William Colgan at York University in Toronto, thanks very much.
Thanks very much for having me, Jeb.
I'm Jeb Sharp, and you're tuned to The World. There's a photo exhibit right now at Harvard University that caught our attention. It's about Iran. The pictures cover a span of 35 years, and women are the central theme. Photojournalist and political sociologist Randi Goodman's latest trip to Iran was just last year, but her first visit dates back to 1980. It was soon after Iran's Islamic Revolution and at the height of the hostage crisis.
3 months after the U.S. embassy had been stormed and the Iranian students had taken the Americans hostage, which I think was about day 73, I went over to Iran with a group of Americans who kind of braved, you know, political opposition to go over and meet with the people holding the hostages to see and learn directly firsthand why it was that the U.S. embassy was stormed and what was the reason for taking hostages. So I was young. I was 24 years old, very interested in world politics. And a journalist friend of mine asked me if I wanted to be the photographer for this delegation of 50 Americans.
And what struck you most when you got there?
Well, what struck me most that I was amidst this amazing political, international political situation, and people were really nice to these Americans who were going over there to just try to have a person-to-person dialogue about, you know, what led up to this international crisis. And as the photographer, you know, often I didn't get into the nitty-gritty of the conversation, but I was there to photograph the interactions, the visits, the interviews, the conversations.
So let's talk about the photographs. What is your favorite image from that time, and what's the story behind it?
Well, I think the theme is, the overriding theme is what's important and something that I only came upon after I got back from my trip in 2015, which had been my first time back in Iran in 33 years. And what I thought about focusing on, though my time in Iran in 2015 was all too short, was to just see how the country had changed. When I first visited Iran, U.S.-Iran relations had fallen apart. And now they were amidst the nuclear, you know, the Iran nuclear agreement proceedings, you know, that was ongoing. And I just thought, isn't this interesting, this juxtaposition of the then and the now? And in the then, it was time in the 1980s where the, you know, Iran was transforming into an Islamic Republic of Iran. So both because of people adhering to their religious and cultural, you know, beliefs more than perhaps before, you know, many women were donning, you know, their chadors or donning more modest dress. Many were doing that both for those reasons and also to show their opposition to the West. Hard to kind of differentiate when you just see people walking on the street, but that's what I saw. And then in comparison, going back in 2015, you have women who are dyeing their hair, you know, putting their scarves way back on their heads, kind of in defiance of some of those beliefs that originally people might have adhered to, not all, but some, and trying to kind of test the limits. This is, you know, amongst the women primarily. I didn't see all that much clothing variation in men. But therefore, my images were to reflect that. So you have some pictures where, you know, women are participating in a mass demonstration and everybody's in a black chador, and it looks, you know, infinite at the university. City of Tehran. And then you have some close-up pictures of girls wearing scarves. And honestly, when the scarves are on someone's head and on occasion and you can see only their eyes and only their expression, you're not distracted by their hair color or whatever, you get to see a different, you know, perspective of an individual. So there's little giggling girls that I have in the center of this one installation in black and white, representing the early 80s, surrounded by this multi-image collage of women in everyday life, all in, produced in color, just gives you a sense of some of the changes. And the changes are about the struggle between tradition and modernity.
And so the 1980s pictures are in black and white.
Yes.
And the contemporary picture or the 2015 pictures are in color.
Yes.
And did you know you were going to do that?
Upon my return, it seemed obvious. But beforehand, when I went there in 2015, I just wanted to pursue a review of the places that were visited, the people I had interviewed, and see what the differences and similarities were. You know, you asked me what my favorite images were. I mean, contemporary image, my signature image of this woman in a green taxi cab. You know, she has her rear view mirror is broken. She's obviously been driving that cab for a while, or hopefully not that she gets in lots of accidents. But, you know, this woman's taxi expresses how in Iran, perhaps unlike other, you know, countries in the Middle East, women can be entrepreneurs. Women can own their own taxi. Women drive, in this case, you know, women only, because that's a way for women to feel more protected, or maybe their husbands or fathers to feel like they could be more protected in their ride to and fro. in addition to that, just thinking about this the other day, and when you go to Iran and you go towards the north, which is kind of the wealthier area of the city, there's a lot of automobiles, there's pollution, there's overbuilding. You know, there's so much investment in Tehran. I mean, mind you, I didn't go outside of Tehran. But I do remember in 1980, when I was there during the hostage crisis, the cranes that were there part of the former investment on the part of European and other companies just were on top of these structures frozen in time because investment really just fled when, you know, foreign investment fled at that time. And now it almost seems like there's so much building that you can't really get from point A to point B.
You're certainly taking us into a world that we don't see from here.
Well, I think that's a role that I think I unexpectedly fell into. You know, when I met an Iranian woman the other day at the previous exhibit over at the Guttman Library at Harvard, and she was taking pictures of that installation that I told you about where the black and white picture of the giggling girls are in the middle. And she simply said she needs to take a picture and show her Iranian mother back in Ohio that there are photographs being shown in the United States of women smiling. And women in professional positions and women doing, you know, everyday life situations without, you know, being totally covered if they so choose.
You mentioned wanting to go back. Do you have plans to go back?
I have the expectation of going back. I perceive this whole thing as the resumption of a project that I started 35 years ago. And I'd like to, you know, explore women not only in Tehran but out in the countryside, women of all classes and professional backgrounds and occupations and education levels. But, you know, while you're there, you can't help but see other aspects of life in Iran. So we'll see.
Randy Goodman there. She's a photojournalist and political sociologist who went to Iran in the 1980s and then again in 2015. You can see some of her work over at PRI.org. And that's all from us today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Jeb Sharp. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.